Illinois faces some big challenges. Today, we're about to hear a truly honest analysis of the problems we face. Equally as important, you'll also hear an in-depth discussion of some practical solutions. This is your radio source for stories, the insight, and the answers you won't hear anywhere else. Not in the media, and not coming from Springfield. You're listening to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Now, here's your host, AM 560's Dan Proft.
Welcome to another edition of Illinois Rising. Dan Proft and a very special co-host, co-combatant this show. I'm engaging in a bit of hyperbole, but it is interesting. Steve Brown, who is the longtime spokesman for House Speaker Mike Madigan, the longtime House Speaker, and the careers kind of mirror one another, right, Steve? I mean, you've been 3 decades with Mike Madigan?
Correct. Since May or June of 1983.
33 years, and he's been speaker for 30
quite a bit of
2 years.
Yeah, there was a two-year break.
All right, yeah, that's when I was with the House, actually, right. On the other side. Mm-hmm. So two men enter the studio today. Only one man's going to leave. That's how we're going to do it.
Hey.
but for somebody who's been in politics, in Illinois politics, Chicago politics, for as long as you have, and served as an advisor to, I think, everyone agrees, the most powerful man in Illinois politics over the course of most of the last 3 decades. I just wanted to give a little a background on yourself, how you got into politics, and then how this relationship with Madigan developed.
Yeah, the getting into it was a bit accidental. I had been a reporter at the Daily Herald. I'd been their political editor, opened their first full-time Springfield bureau, got to know a couple of people who were involved in Jane Byrne's campaign in 1979, or came to help her after she won. They said, well, you seem to know a lot about Springfield. Why don't you come to work for the city of Chicago as sort of a deputy in the Intergovernmental Affairs Office? I had never lived in Chicago before. They said, don't worry about that. We can give you all the information you need. But you know about the legislature. You know about Springfield.
Did you have to stay in Cabrini Green with Jane Byrne?
No, but I was around that night when it all happened. It was probably, I cannot tell you how much of a learning experience to go from the journalism side of it to the government side of it, see all the different challenges that confront people. There's no better education than actually going from one side to the other. And then I got to know Mike Madigan as a result. And so when Jane lost to Harold Washington in 83, he offered to help me find a full-time position. He said, could you help us out with, you know, some of the media duties around the House at the time? And I said, sure, and here we all are. The first couple of corporate things I tried, looked at, didn't really pan out. And along the way, I've done other consulting work over the years, both in Illinois and out of Illinois. And it's not a typical career path. I don't think you can chart that out if you were sitting in a college preparing young people. But it's been interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure there is a typical career path in politics.
Probably not anymore, yeah. Right.
And your first contract with Madigan was like a three-month deal?
3 months.
And
right.
So for the last 33 years, has you just been re-upping that three-month
deal?
Well,
we do it annually.
You graduated to annual?
And so I remained a contractual employee, so I don't have to worry about the pension system personally, right?
Right.
Although I worry about it, you know, from a public policy point of view. But it's been an interesting experience.
Tell us something about Madigan that is not well known. He's not a guy that necessarily avails himself of the media scrutiny a lot, doesn't talk about himself very much, picks his spots. And, you know, there's this stuff about his, you know, he likes to slice up the apples and he's very fastidious.
Yeah, that made big news out of Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, he's methodical, he's studious, right. He's diligent, he's focused. We've heard all those descriptors, sure. But something about working with him on a professional basis for that period of time that people don't really appreciate or understand.
Well, I think they may not appreciate the hours he puts into all this. And so if you're going to be competitive or try to work on something on the opposite side of Mike Madigan, be prepared to come all day. He is the most disciplined human being I've ever met in terms of his daily schedule, in terms of his eating habits, in terms of when he comes and goes. I also think that he is consistent, and if he says that he's going to support something you want to do, you can count on that. If he tells you no, no usually means no. A lot of people, Dan, you probably would agree, politics and government, they love to say yes. That's probably how we got to a lot of our problems.
Right.
And sometimes they say yes, and the last guy or gal through the door is the winner. Sometimes they just say yes to everybody.
Well, I want to talk about some of the problems that the people that are so quick with the yes and not so quick with the supporting the resources for the yes to make the yes come to fruition right after this.
Okay.
Dan Prof back on this special edition of Illinois Rising with House Speaker Mike Madigan's longtime spokesman. He is Steve Brown, who hails from Washington, Illinois, by the way.
Been there about 12 years now. It's a great small town atmosphere.
Yeah.
About an hour's drive from Springfield, so it's an easy back and forth.
Tazewell County.
Yeah.
I've been there. It's a lovely downtown area. Mm-hmm. It's like one of these communities that people don't get outside Chicago Metro too much. You get down to Central and Southern Illinois. There's a lot of quaint communities that have like lovely downtowns. Very interesting.
And nearly fully recovered from the F4 tornado a few years ago.
Yeah,
It'll be the third anniversary of that in November.
Were you impacted by that?
We had no damage. The storm really within about 800 feet of my home made neighborhoods into splinters. We were fortunate only one person died the day of the storm, and a lot of rebuilding. We're probably down to maybe 25 lots that haven't been built on from the 1,100 that were heavily damaged or destroyed by the storm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about rebuilding Illinois' finances.
Sure.
So we find ourselves in the bottom five or at the bottom in sole possession in almost every quality of life metric and financial solvency metric. And I wonder how you would reflect on Mike Madigan's tenure for three decades when 3 decades later, Illinois finds itself where it finds itself.
Sure. And I can understand why some people try to equate that longevity with a responsibility for all the problems. He'll take his share of the blame for things have happened. He'll take some credit for things that he didn't let happen. There were several tax increases along the way that he opposed, and I think people remember that. But I like to point out he's never signed a bill. He's never appointed an agency head, determined where pension fund monies ought to be invested. So he's only part of a process for a long time headed by Republicans, more recently headed by a couple of Democrats, one who just got his prison sentence reaffirmed the other day.
Madigan was his co-campaign chairman in the re-election campaign in 2006,
yeah,
I remember.
And as you remember, that all soured pretty quickly, and Madigan became Rob Blagojevich's boogeyman along the way. So we were around some of these things. We weren't around the idea that the pensioners need a 3% compounded COLA. We weren't around an early retirement plan that helped really worsen some of the pension issues. But, you know, we've also been part of how many hundred school reform ideas. The most recent one, I think the magic idea was, well, let's make it harder for Chicago teachers to strike. That'll improve the learning of our children.
And then there was a strike 18 months later.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not real reform. I can see that point, but
it's the term. Reform is a badly used word, Dan, and I think you would agree with that.
Well, I think as the Tribune opined when Larry Bloom went to jail in Chicago, even the reformers go to jail. reform means some things differently in Chicago and Illinois than perhaps it means in the rest of the free world. But I mean, just in terms of the tenure and the longevity, I mean, 3 decades as House Speaker, he doesn't sign bills, but he does largely exercise control over what bills get called for consideration.
To some extent. But at the same time, if somebody is a proponent of an idea and has 60 votes in the House, they can make a motion to move a bill.
Okay. And during that same time, we have racked up the preponderance of the $212 billion in debt that Illinois currently has. This, according to Truth in Accounting, it's not a Republican number, it's Truth in Accounting's number, juxtaposed against $30 billion in assets. And the largest unfunded pension liability in the nation is part of the problem, but it's not solely the problem. We've also spent well beyond our means in systems that are not financeable, as we've proven in their current form, K-12 education, Medicaid, and the
corrections.
Well, right, but I mean, in terms of the big ticket items in state government, you're talking
check
about
corrections. We're spending a lot of money there too. Yeah, you know? But that's a function of how many decades of Get Tough on Crime and sentencing enhancements, and so the corrections bill is multi-billion dollars now.
But I mean, the Medicaid, K through 12 education, pensions,
right.
Right. And so what about all of those systems that are in cardiac arrest?
Well, in some cases, we've been supportive of efforts and discussions about improving the funding, changing how the funds are distributed, trying to make cuts and savings in Medicaid. States can only do so much because some of that is set down by the federal government. And then practically nothing is done to control the actual cost of health services or pharmaceuticals.
Well, I understand, but I mean, so you had an expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare that was cheerleaded by Pat Quinn and legislative Democrats.
Right. The expansion was, I think, paid for, still is being paid for 100% by the federal government.
Yeah, but that's going to go away.
Or eventually. Yeah.
Right. And we currently, with nearly one in five Illinoisans on Medicaid, have a system we've proven we can't finance. The Kaiser Foundation projects that will go to one in three under the Obamacare Medicaid expansion. You know, how do you make those numbers work? And how do you justify, as you talked about before, saying yes to something that perhaps is appealing to a certain political constituency, but without any means to finance it? How courageous is that?
It's not courageous at all. And it happens, in largely a bipartisan fashion. If you look at some of the changes that have been made to Medicaid, there's been as many Republicans helping with that as Democrats. So it's not a partisan issue in that regard.
So everybody can be wrong.
I'm not disagreeing, and I'm not arguing that we haven't done enough to fund some of these issues. Some efforts have been made; they've not been successful. Madigan, for two sessions now, has been championing the idea of a millionaire's tax that put a special surcharge on the wealthiest to help pay some of these bills for schools. Hasn't been universally beloved.
But, I mean, some of these proposals, the idea more recently under Governor Rauner, which is very recent, they have supermajorities. So Mike Madigan has a supermajority in the House, and John Cullerton has a supermajority in the Senate. I mean, if you want to move legislation, if you want to move a tax increase, for example, you can move it, and you can override the governor's veto. You could certainly send it to his desk, and you haven't done that.
Sure, numerically you could. Well, I think you'd have to have a confidence, frankly, in how the money would be spent, and so therein lies an element of the dilemma we're in. I'm not sure right now there's a lot of confidence in how that spending would occur.
Well, the confidence by the people that have been here for three decades, while the governor's been here 18 months, and who've run up the $212 billion in debt against $30 billion in assets, those are the people that aren't confident about how money will be spent?
They're the ones with the votes to pass the tax.
Well, okay. Well, that's fair.
Okay.
That's fair. Now, speaking of how the money would be spent, it recalls Jimmy John Leotu, the founder of the Jimmy John's sandwich.
Okay, sure.
So when he left Champaign for Florida, moved his corporate headquarters there, one of the things he said, which I found very instructive and it still kind of rings in my head several years later, is, you know, I've been successful in life. I'm happy to pay taxes, at a reasonable level. But the thing that really irks me about Springfield, about state government, is the money I send down to state government does not go to finance what they say it's going to finance. And I'm sick of being scammed by a state government I'm financing. Is he wrong?
No, I think the money probably is being used to pay for the things they say and for a lot more. So I don't think he's wrong. I just don't know that he's seen the whole picture. I don't know how much time he's spent seeing what state spending is all about.
Well, let me put this into concrete, because one of the things that people on both sides of the aisle fail to do sometimes is talk about policy in a way that's, you know, human being focused and tangible and not just abstractions and numbers. So the developmental disability community in this state, you have politicians, both sides again, but Madigan's the House Speaker and Cullerton's the Senate President. They've both been there for, you know, going on four decades. The argument that is made by politicians all the time, I'm going down to Springfield to make sure the truly vulnerable are provided for.
Right.
There are people in this society that need state services through no fault of their own, and we have a moral obligation to provide them. And I agree with that underlying premise. The problem is they're lying to people because after all the money that's been taxed and spent and borrowed and spent, as I've just talked about, where does Illinois find itself? 47th in the nation in the provision of services to developmental disability, to persons with developmental disabilities or a person like that in their family. There's a 24,000 person waiting list for state services where other states, including those around us that are taking families that are leaving Illinois for states that are more civilized, they get those services they apply for post haste. So in terms of the human cost of terrible public policy and reckless spending on things that I don't think people get a real appreciation are being spent versus where they think the money is and should be spent. How do you respond to that? Just to give a tangible example of people that are not being served in Illinois.
There is a need, and there probably should be more spent in that area to help bring that waiting list down to make sure the services are there. I don't know within that particular area that there's waste in the money that's being spent. But when you go and sit down and try and push a budget to fund more for that, then they'll say, well, you got to take something away from schools or corrections or other forms of health care. In that tug of war has got us to where we are today. It's not a pretty picture.
Dan Proft back on this special edition of Illinois Rising with longtime Madigan spokesman Steve Brown. I want to pick up our discussion about the big systems in state government and talk more specifically about pensions. We've sure. Public sector pensions, we've mentioned it, but perhaps it is the most salient financial issue facing the state of Illinois in terms of the impending collapse of pension funds, potentially, depending on whose actuary you believe, right. 5, 7, 10 years for teachers, CPS at least, Chicago Public Schools, 50% funded. Chicago Police and Fire, less than 30% funded. At the state level, of course, we talk about having the highest unfunded pension liability of any state in the nation, in the north of $110 billion. And there's, a growing belief that there is no way a state in the financial condition of Illinois is ever going to be able to live up to the promises it made to retirees as well as future retirees. Do you agree with that, or do you think we're somehow going to figure out how to pay down these obligations and bend the cost curve so that a teacher who's 40 years old today or a state employee who's 40 years old today can realistically believe they're going to get what was promised to them when they retire in 15 or 20 years?
Well, I think that's going to be a challenge, but I think that will be something that can be accomplished. Two things have to happen. One, you've got to put a payment schedule in place that actually pays what we said we were going to give these workers. The courts seem very clear that any real manipulation of the system, of the rules, of the laws that takes something away isn't going to be found constitutional. So I think you have to confront pain. I think you make whatever retirement plan is in effect for future workers, minimize that to the best of your ability, but understand with collective bargaining, that's going to be a challenge.
Well, so when you say pay, put together a payment schedule that can meet those obligations,
right.
There's a story out just this week in Governing Magazine that there's no major public sector pension fund returning more than 1.5% this year.
Right, and they were all these projections were based on, what, 7/8, some numbers like that.
Right.
And they haven't been doing that for a couple of years.
Right.
That adds to the challenge.
There's no question. And so where does the money come from exactly in a state that where residents already pay the highest property taxes in the nation and, according to the Tax Foundation, have the fifth overall highest tax burden in the nation?
Well, you have to look at options like a progressive type of income tax. Perhaps service taxes have been discussed. I'm not sure there's been ever a real concentrated effort to go in that area, but it's going to require revenue. I don't think a manipulation of the system that the Supreme Court in this state is ever going to accept.
And what about the public sector union's posture at this point, specifically AFSCME, because the largest state workers union, AFSCME, representing about 37,000 state workers, has suggested that they're prepared to strike if they can't reach a deal with Governor Rauner. And where Governor Rauner has negotiated 18 collective bargaining agreements with smaller public sector units, unions representing a smaller group of public sector workers, which included a wage freeze. Every single one of them had a wage freeze. AFSCME is demanding, at least at last time I checked, a 29% salary increase over the four-year life of the contract. Depending on, again, whose numbers you want to believe, we're talking about a $1.5 to $3 billion contract AFSCME has proposed that the state can't finance. The state has almost $10 billion in unpaid bills, so just kind of more promises we can't finance, as we were talking about. So what about AFSCME's posture? Is that unreasonable if they would strike? Is it unreasonable if they wouldn't do what the other unions have done and take up wage freeze?
Yeah, I don't anticipate a strike. I think that it's probably a posturing rhetoric in terms of the collective bargaining process. I think from what I hear in those contract talks, if the union believed that the governor was going to have some serious negotiation rather than kind of use them as the pinata for a lot of his different ideas, they might have different terms. But so far, that's not been the case.
Okay, but has AFSCME and SEIU and the teachers unions, have they earned their pinata status? In other words, state government at present, I would argue, is largely set up to finance the salaries and benefits of these state employees and demands, like I just suggested. Now I give credit to the unions that said, we'll take a wage freeze. We have some understanding of where the state's at.
Most of them are better compensated than the rank-and-file AFSCME employees, the record.
But most rank-and-file AFSCME employees are much better compensated than their private sector counterparts in the similar job classifications. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, those private sector counterparts don't have anything approaching the health insurance and pension benefits that state workers have. So again, is AFSCME being unreasonable by saying 29% over 4 years? If you try to do what you did with these other unions, then we're going to strike.
Again, I said I think that is largely rhetoric of a collective bargaining process. And if there was a serious contract negotiation entered into by the administration, I think you'd see more reasonable proposals.
Should they take a wage freeze?
That's in the eye of the beholder. The legislature doesn't get involved in negotiating those salaries.
Well, you tried to.
We tried to have some oversight, because usually what happens is whoever is the governor negotiates a contract, this sends the legislature the bill. And so part of the reason why we got to where we are today in terms of the payroll, the size of the workforce, how many people do what kind of jobs, is because the legislature wasn't involved in really much of that at all. So should they take you would think a wage freeze would be a reasonable idea, and I would assume that could be matched up with some other benefit issues that might make the unions a little more comfortable. But right now there is a pretty heated relationship going on there, and I think you understand that. And I think part of the rounder approach to prosperity. Let's pound public employees.
Well, I think there's a difference between saying, I worked in the public sector. I worked in state government. I worked in local government. I have no antipathy towards people who work in state agencies or corrections or anywhere else in the public sector. You know, they're a mixed bag, just like the private sector. The problem is you can't make these numbers work. And that's what we're talking about. You cannot make these numbers work. You have, just going back to the pensions in terms of pay in, pay out, when people who are not in the public sector hear these numbers, they're aghast. It's just not enough I've heard them. I mean, the idea, for example, that a CPS teacher, and I'm nothing against teachers, but a CPS teacher who pays 140 grand into the pension system can expect a $2.1 million return. In the private sector, you would have to save more than 10 times that to expect that kind of aggregate return.
Right.
And so it's just something that if number one, it's unfair because you have people making 50 grand financing guaranteed benefit levels of a multiple of that. Number two, you can't make the math work. 30 years of Mike Madigan has proven he may be fastidious and he may be focused, but he's not focused on arithmetic.
He's also not focused on COLA, early retirement, the pension investments, you know, the fine work that the various pension systems have done with their fine managers and their, what do we call them, venture capitalists have been taking the money that, you know, so yes.
Well, he signed on to Rob LeGoyevich's $10 billion pension gambit.
That was a bond thing. And that actually, I think, made some sense in terms of the finances of that. If you talk to people, and I was a journalism major, Dan, so I don't claim to have a keen ability to explain every financial
at least
transaction.
That's more than most Chicago members of the Chicago and Springfield press corps are willing to admit, so I appreciate that.
Well, I grew up in St. Louis, so that might, make me a little bit different.
A little but more humility, yes.
You are going to have to pay for these things, and they're going to require, I think you're going to have to look at different ways of finding revenue. And I talked about them earlier. I'll mention them again, a progressive tax and a service tax, for example. And then try to show some restraint in the areas of spending. It's a challenge.
What about structural reform of these systems that we're talking about? For example, K-12 education. And the spending in K-12 education has gone up at a 45-degree angle for the last two decades. And are we getting 45% better in terms of the results, the education of students, the preparedness for college and the workforce?
Yeah, depending on which round of testing, which we keep thinking testing is the whole way to do all this. We're changing that yet another time.
Well, I don't think testing is the whole way to do it. But when 2/3 of children, of 2.1 million children in K-12, are not reading or doing math in fourth grade or eighth grade at grade level, that's a big problem.
Yes, it is.
And so we're not getting bang for our buck, where these systems become third-party administrators to confer salaries and benefits to the adults in the system, regardless of performance. So what about completely rethinking how we do K-12 education in the 21st century, for example, including introducing more competition into the system, like we have at the collegiate level, where you take your Pell Grant, your Stafford loan, your GI Bill dollars, and your schools compete for you, rather than this kind of funding centralized bureaucracies that have proven incapable of educating children.
So you're talking about either vouchers or a broader, a more expansive charter system, for example?
Opportunity scholarships. I mean, really, yes, letting public and private compete for students the way that we have at the university system. Why does it work there, and there's no way it could work at the K-12 level?
I don't know that it can. I'm not sure we've seen examples of it necessarily. I'm not familiar with...
We have 14 states that run 24 different school choice programs. Milwaukee's had one for 20 years.
Okay. But how do you...
Is that something that Mike Madigan and House Democrats, I mean, particularly those that represent minority communities in Chicago, that have seen generation after generation of children not even close to afforded the opportunity to earn a quality education? It's criminal what CPS has done, or more to the point, has not done in terms of providing educational opportunity. And why is there no sense of urgency about rethinking how we're doing something as important as educating children? Everybody agrees this is critical. This is important. This is perhaps the most important thing we do. And yet we continue to fund a system that doesn't produce results.
That's a great question. And I always wonder, in all of these different reforms you hear about every several years, when are we going to have parents held a little more accountable?
Well, sure.
And they largely are off the hook. They want to point the finger at teachers and this and that. And I think we don't do enough to get some accountability out of moms and dads.
I agree about parents. But but here's the thing. There's no question that mom and dad, or the lack of a mom and dad, have the greatest impact on a child's intellectual development. That's clear. But right below them, teachers. Mm-hmm. And you can't legislate a loving two-parent family.
No.
But you can, through legislation, provide opportunity so that the children and families that want to access better have access to better, and they're not discriminated against based on their household income and their address. And that's the system now, at exorbitant prices. I mean, the CPS spends north of $15,000 per kid, which is about 30% more than they spend per kid in Wheaton.
Right.
And let me tell you, Wheaton is producing significantly better results than Chicago. Breaking news.
Sure. I don't argue those facts. I don't think there is a way to argue those facts. We've been involved in this discussion about changing the school aid formula. Senator Andy Menar has an idea. We had a bill that created equity grants to try and smooth out some of the disparity in funding without taking money away from some of the suburban areas mostly. That didn't quite meet the governor's approval, so now the governor has a new task force or commission at work. And I don't know where that's going to lead us. You know, I don't know changing the way you hand out the money necessarily is a way to do it. The question of
that's how you must do it.
The question of choices, though, I know Madigan's been supportive of the different initiatives on charter schools. That's probably the one that's gotten the most attention in Illinois, and the results there. I guess probably mixed. There's been some good success. There's been some troubled. I don't recall a real concerted effort on vouchers. You may know better than I.
Well, I mean, James Meeks 5 years ago.
Sure.
I mean, that was a fairly concerted effort to pass the Senate. It would have been, it would have started. It would have been the seed that could have been germinated in Chicago to prove up the concept and then expanded, assuming it worked like it has everywhere else and like competition works everywhere else in our economy to produce better goods and services at lower costs, except for somehow K through 12 is exempt. And I mean, I think people have a right to ask, is K through 12 exempt because a lot of Republicans, but the entire Democrat Party power structure in this state is beholden to the teachers' unions as well as AFSCME and SEIU, where you get, you know, tens of millions of dollars in funding every year. I mean, that's true.
And we're way behind the guys that are trying to take us all out, right? Even with tens of millions of dollars.
Recently, it's been equalized, but that hasn't been the case for most of the past three decades.
My guess is it's going to be made up. The equalization will be very swift this year, right?
But where are we three decades later? I mean, again, Madigan's probationary period has been pretty extensive.
Mm-hmm.
So after three decades, is it fair to say, well, let's assess what's happened during the course of this time period? And again, he doesn't bear sole responsibility, but he is near the top in terms of having to account for what's happened under his watch when everyone agrees, as we started the show, that he's the most powerful politician in the state.
Yeah, and that's but I'm not sure that's an accurate phrase because of the role he plays is only part of one branch of the government.
So he's just another state rep?
No, he's not just another state rep. He's the leader of one house in a bicameral legislature, mm-hmm. right, in an executive branch. I think we've both been around the executive branch of government. They wield enormous power, have sometimes don't spend a lot of attention to what the law actually says, but what the rules they put together themselves that they create. So there's a lot of problems, Dan. And then there's no argument with that. I'm just saying that I'm not sure I've seen solutions or Mike Madigan has seen solutions that we believe would turn things around.
Dan Prof back on this special edition of Illinois Rising with House Speaker Mike Madigan's longtime spokesman, Steve Brown, who joins us from scenic Washington, Illinois, drove up from central Illinois. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I wanted to pick up on the discussion we were having about K-12 education because we have to talk about the funding side of it, too, and not just the per pupil spending, but where that money comes from. And for most districts in the state, it comes from local property taxes. And with property tax increases in Chicago in the last year by Tiny Dancer and property taxes ever spiraling, generally speaking, we have the highest. Illinoisans pay the highest property taxes in the nation. And I wonder, I've heard you talk previously about the idea that the state should be picking up more of the burden so that property tax relief can be provided. What do you say, and what is the speaker's idea with respect to property tax relief that actually does relieve Illinois families of the overwhelming burden they shoulder?
For a number of years, there was the idea, and you mentioned former Senator Meeks earlier. He was probably the last really strong advocate of the so-called swap that said, well, we're going to cut local taxes, local property taxes, replace it with, you know, state income tax dollars, basically. I'm not sure on final review that anybody could ever actually make that work, and you could put in the controls that kept the local taxes low. And so people have kind of walked away from that idea. Do you give some thought to a local government or a local school, say income tax surcharge, and then replace it that way? Is income a better way to measure a citizen's ability to pay for government services and goods than property? I mean, that was how that all really got going, that they sensed that if you had property, that meant you had means, you had some ability to pay. I'm not sure that's the case anymore.
Well, yeah, right. Go down to South Suburban Cook County.
Right.
Somebody's got a home in Flossmoor that's worth $150,000 today, and they pay $15,000 in property taxes. Sure. I mean, you have tens of thousands of families, hundreds of thousands of families that are going to end up, if they stay in Illinois, and many are not, they're going to pay for their house at least another half to full time, in addition to paying for it, you know, almost twice with a 30-year fixed mortgage. They're going to pay for it another half to full time on property taxes alone. Right. Property tax bills that exceed your monthly mortgage payment. That is not exactly an example of a healthy economy. or sensible public policy, is it? Where your property tax bill would exceed your monthly mortgage?
Well, that's why I'd say this. Is property anymore a reasonable barometer of your ability to pay for goods and services? And so do you need to look at a different, go a different direction in that area?
Well, maybe rather than this kind of Byzantine formula, which by which property is assessed in all 101 counties and Cook County, of course, differently. Maybe we should take it away from the mystics and just have a straight market-based valuation. And like other states do, California, for example, not exactly a bastion of conservatism, you only see a property tax increase when you either improve the property or sell it. And that's a way to truly have property tax caps and may and keep the your property taxes low, so that the largest investment that most people make in their lives is an investment that generates a real return. Okay. Is that fair?
Seems like an interesting idea. I'm not sure all the details of how California works. You know, I think, but you know, they certainly have as many spending issues as Illinois has.
Right, but other states too. Iowa, Indiana, Michigan also have a market-based full valuation at the outset and something very similar. And Indiana has moved to largely state funding of education that way. Mm-hmm. But we have in Florida, again, I mean, just, you know, it's like one of these things. It seems in Illinois we never pick our heads up and look around at the other incubators of or laboratories of democracy for ideas that maybe we can incorporate here. I know Ed Burke does whatever New York has introduced last, but maybe we should broaden our horizon a little bit. So, for example, with respect to the whole funding of schools, I mean, Florida doesn't have an income tax, and it has very low property taxes, and you know, their schools are open. I would say in their major urban centers, they're performing at least as well, if not better, than Chicago. So maybe it's not just all the funding level and the taxation level. Maybe it's about how the money flows and who gets to make spending decisions. Maybe that's what needs to change.
It all ought to be examined. And I think that examination goes on. Do you always get the result you hope for? Probably not. I mean, you've been around this a long time. You know how many different school reform ideas have passed, you know. The last one was let's make it harder to strike. Then we had one created local school councils, numerous testing alternatives. So it sounds good to talk about let's change the way the money is distributed, who makes the spending decisions. How do you come together and cause that to happen?
Well, this is a political will problem. And again, your boss has been around for 30 years, and you've seen all these ideas play out in all these other states. Mm-hmm. So if you were just saying, well, we're going to incorporate best practices from other states, it seems like he's ideally suited, given his position of political strength, to drive that train if he wanted to drive it. And I haven't heard him drive a train on completely rethinking K through 12 in terms of the quality of the schools, in terms of the underlying funding in, you know, forever.
Well, I think there's been those discussions. The question is, can you produce a conclusion that has enough support?
Well, if he's unable to produce a conclusion that has support and positive impact after 3 decades, then should he be replaced with somebody who can?
If you would tell me who that person would be and what that replacement would accomplish.
So you're open to it?
I'm always open to listening.
Oh, okay. Well,
okay? I listen to your show, so I'm open to just about anything.
I appreciate
but
that.
But that's part of the sort of the ruse that goes on with all of these different ideas for term limits or the remap change, things like that. They never tell you what their vision is for whatever the entity is once all that change occurs.
I mean, I'll pull an actuary out of Deloitte and replace Madigan with that person. Mm-hmm. Just somebody that can, you know, kind of operate a balance sheet.
Okay.
How about that? I mean, in a state of 13 million people, there's nobody else who could do a job as good as Madigan has done over the last 3 decades, or many of the other legislators for that matter. I think there are myriad, hundreds of thousands of people that could do a better job. I think you could, you know, throw a dart at a page in the phone book if those things still existed and find people that are better than any number of members of the General Assembly. I mean, my point is, this is the worst governed state in the nation by every measure, 30 years into his reign, And we're pretending like, hey, you know, we're trying to figure it out. We're looking at ideas. We're listening to people. We're, you know, commissioning task forces. And meanwhile, people are leaving this state like the Israelites fled Egypt.
I'm not sure it's all that bad when you get into the... Someday somebody will get into the real background behind the migration issues. They've not really done it yet.
Why are we losing congressional districts every census if we're not losing population?
Because the population in other states is growing faster than we're gaining. We have lost some population. I don't think the migration, though, is due to the government services as much as people would like us to believe.
So you don't think people are leaving, and you have people that still maintain a residence here but are actually official residents of other states, people with means. You think that's just kind of fictional? We don't have a problem?
I'm not sure it's a dramatic problem.
And so the Illinois Policy Institute has estimated that we've lost one person every 10 minutes, for the last 15 years, which is about $25 billion in gross domestic product. Do you dispute those numbers?
I don't have anything to compare them with, so I really don't know. And again, the important thing is to try to figure out the why and what part of it is due to the quality of government service versus your grandchildren are living somewhere, you're retiring, you want to be in a warmer climate. And nobody's ever done that kind of really qualitative analysis of the why part of it.
Well, what about business climate? Do you think businesses and businesses that are here, as well as businesses that are looking at a place to invest, to locate a new facility, do you think that they look at tax and regulatory policy as well as just kind of overall financial solvency of a state, and that impacts their decision?
I don't think it's the top thing they look at. I think a lot of them look at the availability, dependability of utilities, where you are geographically in the country, what the transportation network is like. And so as a result, you see companies coming here. You see announcements. I think on a weekly basis, it seems like you're seeing some new corporate headquarters coming to Chicago, relocating from the suburbs to Chicago. Is it perfect here? Absolutely not. But is it as awful as somebody? Dan, I spent the last week downtown, which was nice.
Yeah.
And there's probably 20, maybe 30 cranes, a lot of big buildings being built. And I think if those people thought things were as bad as someone would portray, those things wouldn't be happening.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one, why do we have an unemployment rate 25% higher than the national average then if everybody's moving here?
I didn't say everybody was moving here. I'm saying there is prosperity here.
I'm saying
there's appearance, at least to me. You go into the center part of the city and you see that many high-rise projects going on. Things can't really be that bad.
Yeah, it's a Potemkin village, though. I live down in that center of the city.
Okay.
So it is very nice. And Chicago's a beautiful city. It would be much more beautiful and probably more robust and a lot safer if we had a different political class there than we've had for the past 100 years. But it is worth pointing out that Brooklyn, there's a story in the New York Post this week. Brooklyn is to pass Chicago, third largest city in the country by 2020. And you know what the secret in Brooklyn is? They have 73 murders this year so far to Chicago's 426.
Right.
And not to mention New York public schools, not necessarily a model, but they're exponentially better, thanks in part to Giuliani and Bloomberg's reform measures, than Chicago public schools in providing opportunities for children to earn a quality education. And so it turns out those things kind of matter. I mean, Chicago, you look at the city center, you look at the three wards or four wards that throw off most of the income, that yes, you have tech people and so forth and young people that want to move and live in the city because it's beautiful and you got the lake and you have all the amenities and the culture, all of which I love. That's why I'm there.
Okay.
And then you get outside that perimeter and you have people being shot and killed every day. You have unemployment rate that is a multiple of the Illinois state unemployment rate. And you have a city that's bankrupt with the Chicago public school system that is junk rated, junk in, junk out. So, yeah, I think it is that bad. And the evidence of it is Brooklyn is going to surpass Chicago and Houston is going to surpass Chicago. And the business climate in these other states, based on who's moving there and what they're throwing off, seems to be significantly more robust since Illinois is in the bottom five in job creation for the last 5 years running.
And yet that perimeter you mentioned is grown by blocks and blocks and blocks over the last, 10, 15 years? All that west loop, south loop, that's
Yeah, I understand.
You have to, I think you have to acknowledge.
I live there. I acknowledge
okay.
it. I've seen what's happened to the city since I've lived there the last 15 years. But that's 250,000 people in a city of 2.7 million. So,
I don't think it's as desperate or it's a non-prosperous place. I think things can be better. Sure.
It's prosperous for a small fraction of the population.
I don't know that that's the case. You see, thousands of people coming and going to work every day. So I don't think it's a small fraction of the population. Can conditions improve? Should we try to get a handle on it? I'm not sure exactly the way on the crime and the violence in Chicago. Yes. But I don't think the constant drumbeat that says, oh, this is an awful place, everybody's leaving, really tells the whole story.
No, I'm not saying it's an awful place. I'm saying that the people in charge of city and state government are awful. That there's a difference between those two states.
Well, there's been a variety of people over time. So a lot of partners. So
I agree.
So we would need.
But I'm just talking about the current crop. But agree.
No, I talk about the crop that put it all in place. And they go back a number of years.
Yeah, I know. Like Mike Madigan, who's been there 30.
Well, let's go back to Jim Thompson, Jim Edgar, George Ryan.
Let's.
Okay.
I agree.
Right.
I'm in vociferous agreement.
And so why, how could it possibly be that these things are so awful and you have all these ideas, we can't get somebody to come in and make it all better?
Because, it's
amazing.
It's not a white knight. It's people that have bought into a government-centric view of society, including those Republican governors that you mentioned. They have absolutely been part and parcel of the problem. They were terrible governors, every single one of them. And they facilitated what Madigan has exponentially increased as House Speaker and the most powerful man in the state.
I think he gave him a little too much credit.
No. Maybe
he had a good PR guy that helped build that
yeah,
image.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, right.
So
yes.
We'll come back, and then we'll try to find these people that can come in, win election, and then work with 118 others.
Well, win election, right. I mean, because you
Because what, we're going to abolish the elected form of government?
No.
Oh, okay.
But to win election here, I mean, especially on your side of the aisle, you just have to, be a wholly owned subsidiary of the public sector unions. That's how you win election. But the problem is then you're beholden to those people that financed you, especially
with
those people.
Just to get up and say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Well, I understand. I agree that we need to find a wider array of talent to run for legislative office and statewide offices for that matter, and that we need to switch out some of the personnel. But it's not just a personnel problem. It's a political culture problem. It's a kleptocratic political culture, rent seekers. It doesn't matter what you do. It matters how much political clout you have. No, it doesn't matter the quality of the good or service you provide. It matters, if you can get a meeting with Ed Burke or Tiny Dancer or Mike Madigan or John Cullerton, you meet them over at Tavern on Rush. That's what matters. Well, that's a terrible way to do government in a free society, and we're a terrible government in a free society.
And if that was really the way it was happening, Dan, I think I would agree with you. I don't think that's the way it happens. I think an awful lot of people who come to the government at whatever level with issues, with problems, aren't the wealthy, aren't heavily lobbied up, get pretty good satisfaction.
Well, like the 24,000 families with a family member who has developmental disability waiting in line for services that we guarantee them.
That's a problem.
Dan Proft back on this special edition of Illinois Rising. Joining me is House Speaker Mike Madigan's longtime press spokesman, Steve Brown. So, Steve, a question, a little bit of a conversation about electoral politics. Why won't Mike Madigan let Lisa run for governor?
It's her decision completely.
Uh-huh.
And I for one, thought it would be an interesting challenge at some point to have her run for governor and the speaker stay in office and see how that debate goes. She made a decision. She didn't think that would work. And here we are.
And do you think that there's any inkling that she may change her decision or that House Speaker Mike Madigan may be willing to defer to his daughter and step aside so that she feels comfortable running?
Yeah, I've seen some reporting. I think it happened while we were in Philadelphia at the convention where she was saying things about running for governor that suggested she might change her view. But I don't know that. I don't speak for her. I don't think the speaker has any near-term plans to retire.
Yeah, that seems seems pretty clear that he doesn't want to retire.
Right.
Yeah. Just generally speaking about the 28 governor's race, and talk, we'll kind of work our way back to 2016 and legislative races. But
you know, it's amazing the way people just, you know, in Illinois, we skip past whatever's right in front of it.
Well,
and
no.
it happens all the time.
Well,
and I think it's unique, pretty unique to Illinois in terms of the volume. And I mean, because you hear that discussion, you hear about 18, and you hear about the next mayoral election.
Sure.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, one side or the other has a vested interest in changing the balance. So, of course, you're going to have people talking about it. And then when you have people openly speculating about it and a poll being done to say who would be the best Democrat to go up against Bruce Rauner, for example, that feeds the conversation.
Sure.
And so who would be the best Democrat to go up against Bruce Rauner? And is Dick Durbin a serious possibility?
Well, Dick Durbin continues to talk about it. You would think that with his career in Washington, that would be a pretty big change, going from the legislative branch in the U.S. Senate to the executive branch of the state. I think he certainly knows what to do. I think he's an experienced campaigner. And I would be surprised if he made that change. I think he'd be a terrific candidate.
What about Pat Quinn? He's making noise again. He's, passing petitions in Chicago for this and that.
And I'm not sure that Pat has the appeal to be successful. He angered a lot of people with some of the things he did while he was in office, to the point that they turned and voted for Governor Rauner. I think the governor mistakenly thought those were votes for him more than being votes against Governor Quinn.
Yeah, repudiation of Quinn.
Yeah. And so that's where I think Rauner's found himself in some problems, because he's gone into areas which he carried, thinking, I can push my ideas, and they haven't been, you know, universally beloved. What Quinn decides to do, I'm not certain. I'm not really a close confidant of him. So I just don't think he would have a broad appeal as he once did.
Speaking of Governor Rauner and Mike Madigan, was the governor wrong to think that he was going to be able to sit down and hammer out some kind of budget deal with Mike Madigan that included at least some of what he had outlined as his policy agenda?
Well, I don't think that he was wrong. I'm just never sure what he's actually trying to attempt to accomplish at any particular time.
Well, so, I mean,
so I think there have been efforts to deal with the state finances, as the speaker points out. There have been six or seven or eight, I lost count right off the top of my head, Dan, of appropriation bills that have been passed for various full budget, partial budget, clean up the mess from the fiscal year before Rauner came in. And we've been able to do that and pass bills and do it in a pretty bipartisan fashion. It's just when they get all tangled up with the other things he wants to do, that's what becomes harder. And then, in my honest opinion, if the guy had learned how to take a victory lap on some things, we'd be much further down the road.
For example?
Work comp. House passed a bill, Senate passed a bill, could have reconciled it, wasn't good enough for him, because I think he's got advisors who say, oh, no, you got to get 100%, you got to get 100% of what you want on a particular topic before you can really be satisfied.
I'm not sure that's the case.
Well, I think that's what I've seen play out.
Okay. Well, I mean, I know to kind of his inner circle of advisors, many of whom previously worked for Mark Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they, generally speaking, and as does Governor Rauner, he wouldn't have made all the money he made if he didn't know when to declare victory. And frankly, recognize that sometimes you need to take half a loaf rather than if you can't get the full loaf. And I think that's a philosophy. It seems to me, just going back to those collective bargaining agreements, that he's been willing to negotiate with people that come to the table and successfully as well, that come to the table in good faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, all I see is where we've tried to do some of the things he's wanted to do, maybe not 100% his way, and he's resisted.
Is it more because he has seemingly been negotiating against himself? I mean, he lays out a turnaround agenda, then he's willing to walk it back in, all the while saying, I'm open to revenue if we talk about at least some of what I'm talking about here and what I want here in these structural reforms. But then he negotiates against himself, so you're just letting your a political opponent negotiate against himself rather than having to compromise to move the flag on, for example, passing the first truly balanced state budget in, say, 15 years.
Yeah, I don't know that he's really negotiating against himself. I think he's realizing that he's not been persuasive on some of these things. I mean, he talks about, he uses the term local control as if it was really going to be applied, but he's going to tell local governments what they could control and how they could control it. So that's not really local control. Many of them, several hundred, have said no thanks. And so then he walks back from different things, you know. So I just think he could have had some near-term accomplishments that were on that list in the first session of the General Assembly. He missed an opportunity. And then all the things that have gone on since then, all the advertising and the candidates and all that stuff, has just kind of made things a little bit harder. Not impossible, but harder.
So, speaking of advertising, there seems to be some confusion, so in advance of the state legislative races, because these are really important legislative races,
sure.
To see if Democrats can maintain their supermajorities in both chambers or not. Do you, and does Mike Madigan, because I know he's a smart guy and he reads and so, you know that state government has nothing to do with Social Security and Medicare, right?
Pretty much, right.
Yeah. Okay, because sometimes it's confusing because House Democrats and the Democrat State Party send out mailers saying Republicans are going to cut your Social Security or your Medicare, mm-hmm. and there's no state legislative Republican or any state legislator that could do that even if they wanted to because they're federal programs. And so I just wonder if that's something where you're just not familiar with how the federal government works versus state government, or you're being disingenuous.
Yeah, I know how the federal government works. I'm not familiar with those mailers. I've heard them mentioned from time to time, but I'm not familiar with them.
If I give you copies, could we get a response in terms of whether or not those will cease so that we all understand what we're talking about and we're not talking about issues over which state government has no control?
Well, it's hard to talk about ceasing something that I don't know that we had any involvement with to begin with.
Well,
but if you've got copies, send them along.
He's the chairman of the state Democrat Party, right?
Send it along, Dave.
Is it paid for, on those things?
Send them along.
Okay. All right. Very good. So on state legislative races, how important is the supermajority to Mike Madigan? Or is it something where he'd rather have a workable majority and fewer mouths to feed?
Well, I think the use of that term, which is one I don't use, is not realistic because it's not a working three-fifths. Okay, not all Democrats walk down the same side of the street every day. Some issues they do, many they don't. You'll have people who are for things, people who are never going to vote for any kind of tax hike. So you don't really have that three-fifths that people like to talk about. Smaller group is easier to work with, but the more the merrier. And it looks like there's some popular people around the state.
Does the speaker think, I should say, you guys, I need to be so generic about it, but does the speaker think that regardless of what happens at the presidential level or even statewide level with Kirk versus Duckworth or Munger versus Mendoza, that you're well positioned to maintain that supermajority, maybe even pick up seats by running against Governor Rauner?
I think it's going to be a hard-fought campaign season. It's going to be very expensive. I think we'll see spending as we've never seen before in Illinois. In some of these legislative races, you're liable to see spending that looked like what we used to spend for the governor's race a few years ago.
Truly.
And I don't do predictions, is my final cop-out on that for you.
Okay.
In terms of what we might get. There are some candidates working hard in the districts held by Republicans, though.
After 30 years, just kind of a closing thought on this, insight from you. After 30 years at the helm, do you think Mike Madigan has any regrets about political or policy choices, given where Illinois finds itself?
I'm sure he probably does. I don't think I've ever had that conversation with him, so I wouldn't be able to enumerate. But I can't imagine that he stands there today and thinks everything was terrific all along, given some of the things that have gone on.
Does he care about policy, or is it just about power politics and maintaining his role as speaker?
Well, I think you have to care about the policy because that's what makes the politics work. If you have good policies in place, if you're responsive to people with what they need to do in their districts, that's how you win their political support, in my opinion.
Well, but Illinois seems to be an outlier in that, though, too. You've had terrible policy and still political support.
That's why I think that the policy, that the situation in Illinois, not as bad as some would like to portray.
All right, Steve Brown, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah.